Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Sasha Pfeiffer, and this is On Point. Another day for the history books on Capitol Hill. A career U.S. diplomat who once helped Ukraine end a war with Russia will now help U.S. lawmakers understand President Trump's efforts to get Ukraine to potentially harm one of his political rivals.
I've been going through this for 3 years. They've been trying to impeach me from the day I got elected. And you know what? They failed.
As President Trump rails against what he calls a corrupt system, the House's impeachment inquiry takes another step forward today in a secret room behind closed doors in the U.S. Capitol. This hour on Point, the president's defense and the House Democrats leading the charge. With us from Washington, D.C. is John Bresnahan. He's a senior congressional reporter for Politico. John, thank you for being with us during a very busy week on Capitol Hill.
Hi, Sasha.
John, can you give us a rundown of what's happening today? And we should note that as we're going to air, things are still unfolding. But tell us what's happening now and what we know now.
Well, there will be a deposition this morning of Kurt Volker. He's a former special envoy to Ukraine. He just left the other day. He just left his job. And as you mentioned, he's a career diplomat. He's being deposed by three committees, staffers from three committees and members. It's House Intelligence Committee, Foreign Affairs, and Oversight and Reform Committee. And they're deposing him as what was his role in this Ukraine scandal, the still unfolding Ukraine scandal for President Trump.
And as you mentioned, John, Kurt Volker just left his job. He resigned from that position. Why is it significant that he did that?
Well, this allows him to testify that he resigned after the whistleblower complaint was released. He was in a unique position. He was a career employee, but he was still actually only part time. He was actually still lobbying, working for a Washington lobbying firm, interestingly enough. And he had to get actually some ethics waivers to continue to do that from the State Department. But it's significant that he left because now the State Department, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has objected to the House Democrats' attempts to get testimony from several other State Department employees.
So by resigning, did Volker in a sense free himself up to do that?
He did. He's no longer under the jurisdiction of the State Department. They could raise issues, I guess, on classified material, but these committees have waivers. The staffers on these committees have classified they're allowed to hear classified information, so they will be able to hear that. So he did. He's no longer under the jurisdiction of the State Department since he is a former employee.
There were other depositions, high-profile depositions that had been scheduled. Some of those ended up in a somewhat of an uncertain status. Can you tell us who else might be appearing before these committees and what the timeline for that may be?
Yeah, there's a total of five State Department employees, including Maria Yovanovitch, who is the former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, who was recalled earlier this year under orders from President Trump. And then there's several other State Department employees who've also been called. Now, Yovanovitch has said she wants to testify. It's not clear she will be able to. And the three other State Department employees, Pompeo is refusing to do that. So we may see some subpoenas actually tomorrow. House Oversight Committee Chairman Elijah Cummings of Maryland has said he wants some information from the State Department by tomorrow as his deadline, or he's going to issue subpoenas.
And the woman who was the ambassador to Ukraine that you mentioned is interesting because she was actually referenced by President Trump in the call he had with the president of Ukraine.
Yes, he disparaged her. He called her very bad. And it was with somebody, Rudy Giuliani, the president's personal lawyer, had pressured the White House and the State Department to remove her. She'd been under pressure from the right wing conservative media because they trashed her, as saw her as somebody who was not really serving the president's interests in Ukraine, including his whole idea that Ukraine was somehow involved and Ukrainian officials were somehow involved with Democrats in the 2016 election and somehow had played some role in that election in supporting Hillary Clinton.
John, we're only a week into this impeachment inquiry, but it has consumed enormous amounts of media attention, public conversation. It feels like it's moving quickly, even though it's only been a week. Do you have a sense of what the timeline is? I mean, this may feel front-loaded with speed, but this is going to play out for a long time to come, I imagine.
It's going to take a couple months, though it is moving very rapidly. I covered the 1998 Clinton impeachment, and that took almost pretty much a year to occur. This will not take that long. The House, if it does act, it's right now they're going to assemble information from six committees and send it to Judiciary Committee. And if there are articles of impeachment, Judiciary Committee will vote those out or will craft them and vote on them. I think the timeline is somewhere between Thanksgiving and maybe early December. I don't think the Democrats in the House, Speaker Nancy Pelosi and other House Democrats wanted this to drag in their chamber at least into 2020. But this could move into 2020 potentially in the Senate if the House does vote and impeaches President Trump.
John, please stay with us until we go with a break, but I want to bring in someone who is on the Judiciary Committee you just mentioned, and that is U.S. Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal. She is a member of the Judiciary Committee, which, as you said, is key in this impeachment process. She represents Seattle, and she supports the impeachment inquiry. Congressman Jayapal, thank you for coming onto the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
So a same question for you that I just put to John. This feels very rapid, very quickly. Could you give us some sense of what timeline you see this impeachment inquiry laying out on?
Well, I think it is exactly as John said. I don't think we know exactly what the timeline will be. But what we do know is that we are going to do a thorough and fair investigation, and we are going to make sure that we have all the facts in hand. I think one of the things that is very different about this than the work we were doing before is that this is a level of lawlessness that has unfolded in front of the public. We have evidence in hand that the president endangered our national security, and the White House's record of the call shows President Trump asking President Zelensky to, quote, do us a favor, though. And those are very, very important words. And so I think now what you see in the subpoenas, different from what we were doing before, is that if the president, the White House, the administration continues to not allow information to come to the committees that have oversight, then that will be construed as obstruction of Congress. And that is laid out in the subpoenas, in everything that we are, all the materials that we are sending. Because that has been, I think, this administration's playbook is tie things up in the court, refuse to send information, claim fake privilege. That's not going to be allowed to happen anymore.
President Trump frames this as the Democrats are out to get me, that they still cannot accept the results of the 2016 election. They're doing anything they can to get me out of office. Assuming you hear that potentially from some of your constituents, how do you respond?
Well, I think that what we have been saying, and I think actually the majority of Americans are starting to see this as well, is that this president has endangered our national security. It is a new level of lawlessness. He withheld critical military aid to counter Russian aggression that Congress had authorized. He abused his power by pressuring a foreign country to interfere in the 2020 election, and then he used the levers of government to try to cover it up. And this is not an isolated instance. It is actually what we have been investigating for the last several months. The difference, again, as I said, is it is in plain view. He bragged about it. It is unfolding in front of us. Everything that we see so far is not only corroborating that single charge around Ukraine, but is also telling us that we have other things that we also need to be looking into, other call records that perhaps were put into confidential safes that should not be there. Not that calls can't be confidential between world leaders, but if they're being scrubbed for things that the president was saying that abused his power, that is a problem. So Most of our constituents, I would say, understand that and understand that nobody came into office to try to impeach the president. That's not what we want to do. In fact, we have spent the last 6 months that we've been in the majority, or 9 months that we've been in the majority, passing over 135 bills that have to do with the real issues that face Americans today. However, the fact is we have a president who refuses to respect the Constitution and who is betraying his oath and betraying the very essence of our democracy. That's why the founders gave us Article I powers, and we intend to take them very, very seriously.
I want to play a piece of sound from Adam Schiff, the House Intelligence Committee chairman. This is where he was talking to reporters and telling them that his committee will assume that the administration is trying to conceal facts if it doesn't comply with committee requests for witnesses or documents. Here's what Adam Schiff said about that.
We are concerned that the White House will attempt to stonewall our investigation, much as they have stonewalled other committees in the past. It's why I say the White House needs to understand that any action like that that forces us to litigate or have to consider litigation will be considered further evidence of obstruction of justice.
Again, that was Adam Schiff. Congresswoman Jayapal, how do you plan to proceed if you feel that you're not being given what you are required to be given?
Well, I think at some point we'll have to make a decision if that obstruction of Congress, obstruction of justice, constitutes enough for the committees to take the next step and recommend articles of impeachment. But we're not there yet. And what I would say is that had we not seen the constant pattern that we experienced in Judiciary Committee with, for example, Corey Lewandowski, coming to testify but being under a fake privilege that doesn't exist of the White House so that he couldn't give us any information, other people who have ignored their subpoenas. Had we not seen that constant pattern of a president that seems to not understand that there is a balance of power here, checks and balances built into the Constitution so that no dictator, no demagogue could take over our democracy, we may not be moving with the same pace that we are moving now. However, this is a pattern.
Thank you for that. That's Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal. She represents Seattle and is a Democratic member of the House Judiciary Committee. Thank you for making time for us also this busy week. And John Bresenhan, senior congressional reporter at Politico, thank you for staying with us till this break. Very much appreciate it. After the break, the U.S. Supreme Court is about to begin its new term. With a conservative majority on the bench, is preparing to take on cases involving the biggest issues dividing Americans. Stay with us. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. Transgender rights, protections for young undocumented immigrants, public funding for religious schools. Those are three of the major issues that we know the U.S. Supreme Court will wade into when it starts hearing arguments for this new term next week. And as the court takes on polarizing topics like abortion, it will do so with a conservative majority that could reshape the court for a generation. Listeners, join this conversation. Let us know how you think the Supreme Court's new conservative majority could affect its decisions. Do you think it's possible the Supreme Court will overturn Roe versus Wade this term? Should the court uphold protections for young undocumented immigrants known as Dreamers? What role do you think President Trump's Supreme Court picks will play in its decision-making? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. With us from Washington, D.C. is David Savage of the Los Angeles Times. He's been covering the U.S. Supreme Court since 1986, and he has reported on the confirmations of all the current justices. David Savage, thank you for coming on the program.
Hi, Sasha.
David, I think this is such an interesting beat you cover, and it's a particularly interesting beat right now as the composition of the court, of its bench, changes quite a bit. So before we talk about some of the cases that we know the court will hear, lay the groundwork for us a bit here. We have a sort of a newly bolstered five-justice conservative majority now that Brett Kavanaugh and Neil Gorsuch are on the bench together for a full term. That changes the previous makeup. Talk to us a bit about the new court, what it looks like, what expectations are for that as a result of the changing makeup.
Well, it is mostly expectations. You know, Brett Kavanaugh arrived October of last year, and last term, it seemed like John Roberts wanted to do everything he could to avoid big controversial cases, to sort of put things off. So we haven't seen too much of the new conservative court last year, but it looks like we'll see more of it this year. You know, one of the things that really changes the dynamic in the legal system is that lawyers all around the country and interest groups sort of look to the Supreme Court and think, can we win something there? Or can we lose? And for the last year or so, a lot of the conservative interest groups on things like religious liberty and abortion in particular now say now's the time to get our cases to the Supreme Court. And conversely, a lot of the liberal groups are doing everything they can to keep cases away from the court. So what happens over time is that more of the issues that start percolating up to the Supreme Court are sort of conservative agenda items. And so we're starting to see some of that.
You mentioned John Roberts, and he came in viewed as a more conservative justice, yet interestingly has now essentially shifted to the court center. And in many cases was a more moderate vote in a sense than people anticipated he would be. You made a reference, David, to feeling that Roberts' last term tried to avoid perhaps more hot-button issues. Do you actually consider that deliberate? Do you feel that with all the controversies surrounding the Supreme Court lately, Justice Roberts, Chief Justice Roberts, was careful in terms of how he guided the court and perhaps how they picked what cases they wanted to hear? Is that what you're suggesting?
Yes, absolutely. I think he would tell you that if you ask him, there's no need. You know, Roberts is the Chief Justice, and he cares about the court as an institution. And every time he goes out to talk, he says to the people, you know, we're not political. We're not like part of the polarized Washington. We're different. We're a court. He wants the public to believe that they're in the business of law, not politics. And so if you get a new, more conservative justice, and then immediately the court takes up a lot of big cases and changes the law dramatically— You know, most Americans think it's a political body just like the rest of Washington. So John Roberts has been very much had an interest in saying, let's not move too far. Let's not move too fast. We can decide cases narrowly or we can avoid big issues. So, yes, he would like the court to move in a sort of gradual direction. I do think he's a fundamentally conservative justice who, in the end, will agree with the other four conservatives, but his interest is, for now, moving sort of slowly and deliberately, not quickly and dramatically.
So even if that was a good move in terms of stability and public respect for the court, to not to blow things up too quickly, is that the right move societally? I mean, by delaying making difficult decisions in controversial cases, is there a disservice done because decisions that really need to be made get delayed in an effort to make the court appear more stable?
Well, I suppose there are different views on that. And what, you know, for example, the obvious big issue is Roe versus Wade and abortion. That's been a matter of controversy for 40 years, and it never seems to go away. A lot of Republican states are passing essentially abortion bans, not just regulations, abortion bans. at some point, the court's going to have to confront that issue again directly. But I think Roberts believes, and that for the good of the legal system, the court should move very cautiously and deliberately on that issue. I think this term, the court will take on one or two cases that are sort of regulatory issues, issues involving regulated abortion clinics. They're abortion cases, they're important, but they're not abortion bans. And I just think he thinks the proper role of the court is not to rush to change the law in a big way. I suppose if you were one of the legislators who passed one of those abortion bans in the conservative states, you would say he should, you know, the court should take that up right now and overturn Roe versus Wade in a couple months. I think Roberts' inclination is that that's not the right approach.
Listeners, we're talking about the new U.S. Supreme Court term, which begins Monday. We're going to be talking about some of the cases it will be hearing, cases involving abortion, immigration, transgender rights. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at On Point Radio. Let us know if you feel that the new 5-4 conservative majority is likely to have an impact in how decisions are made. Or the last term, when there was also a conservative majority, were you surprised that it was a more moderate outcome on many cases than people expected? And let's go to a caller. This is Phil calling from Bradenton, Florida. Phil, welcome to On Point. And what are your thoughts about the upcoming Supreme Court session?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My thoughts are this court is in the process of destroying its legitimacy.
And why do you think
four that? Four of the nine judges were appointed by presidents who lost the popular vote in their elections. And
you're referring to George W. Bush and Donald Trump.
Absolutely. And the decisions made by this court in small part already and what is likely to occur in the near future are in no way reflective of the views of the general public. Because of the fact that the process for electing presidents is not optimal, and because of the fact of the way that these judges were appointed and confirmed. And if this is what Justice Roberts wants, the future is going to be very different. How the court is going to function, how justices are going to get onto the court or stay on the court or the size of the court, it may change. We have no idea what's going to happen. This court is not reflecting the views of the general public. That's my opinion.
Phil, were your concerns allayed at all because the decisions that came out of last year's term of the Supreme Court were not as drastic as some people thought they may be? Did it make you think that perhaps it will be a more moderate court than you anticipate?
No. No, because you know they can play a long game. They're lifetime appointments. So if they decide to do something, you know, a little moderate for a short amount of time, if we can even use that word, that's in the big picture, that doesn't mean anything. It's you know what happens going forward if they make decisions that do not reflect the wishes of the general public at large, if elections keep on happening that do not reflect the results of the general public at large, they are destroying their legitimacy. And that's, you know, just another disaster for democracy, in my opinion.
Phil, thank you for that. David Savage of the LA Times, I'm interested in your thoughts on that argument Phil makes, that the court is losing its legitimacy. Do you think there is truth to that, or do you think perhaps in the public eye there is a truth to that?
Well, I guess I find it hard to gauge. I suspect there are millions of people around the country who are unhappy with the court, were unhappy with the Kavanaugh confirmation, were very unhappy with the fact that Mitch McConnell didn't allow a vote on Merrick Garland. There's a lot of reasons for tens of millions of people to be dismayed by what has happened in the appointment process. But I must say, we are going to have these justices for a very long time. And they don't seem like they were going to go away, or that the majority is going to switch anytime soon. We're in a situation now where the conservative justices are the young people on the court. The two oldest justices are Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who's 86, and Stephen Breyer, who's 81.
Sure. And Ruth Bader Ginsburg, health clearly fragile, it appears.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so it's not from the point of view of liberals and Democrats, it's not going to get better. As I mentioned earlier, I think one of the things is a whole lot of liberal interest groups will be trying to avoid taking big issues into court. And what you may hope is you could win the White House and the Senate at some time and make change through legislation, not through litigation, as long as the Supreme Court has a solidly conservative majority.
Well, is the flip side of that, if there are liberal groups avoiding cases going before the Supreme Court, are there conservative groups that are trying to get them there because they feel they have a pretty advantageous chance of getting an outcome they would like?
Oh, sure. There's a series of gun regulation cases that are constantly being sent up to the court because the advocates of the Second Amendment think that the Supreme Court with Brett Kavanaugh will go further down to say, about 10 years ago, they said the Second Amendment gives you a right to have a handgun at home for self-defense. And the court since then has refused to rule on whether that right includes carrying guns in public or carrying guns in your car. And there's a whole series of those cases. So if you're on the conservative side, the Second Amendment side, you want to push those cases and get them up to the Supreme Court because you think you will win.
Right. In fact, Justice Clarence Thomas, who is certainly viewed as very conservative, I believe has been outspoken in saying he wishes the court would take up more Second Amendment cases and address the gun issue.
Absolutely right. And what apparently had happened was that Justice Kennedy, who would be the fifth vote for thing, wasn't enthused about going further. And so those cases get turned down. It takes four votes to grant a case and five votes to rule. And so in their private meetings, if you know that we're not going to have five votes, there's no use taking the case. Now, when you've got Brett Kavanaugh around the table, and you're on the Clarence Thomas side, you would say, let's take that case because we will prevail. So on that area, on religion, a whole lot of areas, conservative groups are taking their cases and issues to the court.
And David Savage of the LA Times, let's go to another caller. This is Jake calling from Pawhuska, Oklahoma. Jake, welcome to the program and tell us your thoughts about the current Supreme Court, its makeup, and any cases you may be keeping your eye on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I know they don't teach civics classes anymore, but when I was in school, they did. And as I understood it, the judicial branch was there to judge cases based on the law legislated by the House and the Congress and not to be politicized. But I think we're seeing almost the exact opposite of that, or I was mistaken. I'll just take my answer off here. Thank you.
Sure. David Savage, do you want to address that thought?
Well, I guess it depends on, you know, as always, sort of what your view is, what's political and what's legal. It's an interesting case up on Tuesday morning, a big issue about essentially the issue is, are gays, lesbians and transgender people in half the country protected from being fired because of their sexual orientation or gender identity?
These are cases that fall under the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Is this right?
Yes. And that's why I mentioned it, because he said, how do you interpret federal law? Well, federal law in 1964, they said it's illegal to fire somebody because of race, religion, or because of sex. Now, in 1964, no one thought that meant gays and lesbians. But Justice Scalia, among others, has repeatedly said, we decide cases based on what the law says, not what the legislature has in mind. And so, lo and behold, federal appeals courts in New York and Chicago and Cincinnati in recent years have said discrimination based on sexual orientation or transgender is sex discrimination and is therefore illegal. And so that's essentially the issue the court will be arguing about on Tuesday. Does the 1964 Civil Rights Act protect gays and lesbians and transgender people from being fired because it's discrimination because of sex?
We actually have a piece of sound related to that case. It involves a transgender woman named Amy Stevens. She's at the center of that case. The Supreme Court will hear next week. And she says she was fired from her job as a funeral director in Detroit after she told her boss that she would be transitioning to present as a woman. So she was going to come in traditionally female clothes to work instead of what she had traditionally worn, traditionally male clothes. Here's a bit from her from a video produced by the ACLU.
I'd given almost 7 years of my life, my expertise to them, worked on countless cases that nobody else could have done with the same result. And then something like this comes up, we don't need you. They did their investigations, and the sad thing is he admitted that he fired me because of the reason why. And that was that I was going to come dressed as a woman.
And David Savage of the LA Times, if I understand that case correctly, an appeals court agreed with Amy Stevens and said, yes, you were discriminated against. And is it now that the Supreme Court, that's made it up to the Supreme Court and the Supreme Court will weigh in?
Yes, that's right. They're taking two cases on sexual orientation, one where the employee won, one where the employee lost, and then this case involving the transgender employee from Detroit. That's a classic situation where the court intervenes. I think John Roberts would tell you that's the kind of case where they have to decide, where the federal appeals courts in one part of the country say one thing about the Constitution or federal law, and federal appeals courts in another say the opposite. So they're going to hear those cases on Tuesday. The Trump administration is in on the employer's side, and they say sex is biology. It's not gender identity, and it's not sexual orientation. But the lawyers for the transgender employee have, I think, a pretty good simple common sense view, which is if you go to work on Friday and you're a male and you return on Monday and you're a female and your boss says, okay, you're fired, that sure sounds like discrimination because of sex.
David Savage of LA Times, hold for us till we go to a break. We'll be back. Listeners, we're discussing the big cases the U.S. Supreme Court has taken up this term. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. We'll be back after a break. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. Abortion, immigration, LGBTQ rights, these are issues at the root of fierce debates in U.S. politics and in American society. Now the U.S. Supreme Court is preparing to possibly take a stance on these issues in its upcoming term, which begins Monday. Democrats are fearful of how the conservative majority could rule. Republicans are energized by their grip on the judiciary. Listeners, join the conversation. Are you pleased with the changes in the makeup of the Supreme Court? Do you anticipate a lot of ideological splits with 5-4 rulings? What cases are you watching? What outcomes are you hoping for? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. We're joined by David Savage. He's a staff writer for the LA Times who has covered the U.S. Supreme Court for more than 30 years. And David, we have a lot of callers who want to weigh in, so let's go to some of them immediately. This is Chuck calling from Bridgeton, Maine. Chuck, welcome to On Point, and tell us what you think about the new Supreme Court, its new conservative makeup, and some of its decisions so far.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm just one of the people who've been looking and waiting for good news to come out of Washington for the past few years, and feels as though this, this sort of unexpected moderate feeling we're getting, you know, from the court is good news. And it seemed to me that, you know, in the earlier discussions that there's the people we have on air are suspicious of this and think it might be sort of a long-term strategy to set us up for much more conservative decisions in the future. I'm hoping, and I guess it's more of a comment than a question, I'm just hoping it's a sincere and real surprise, pleasant surprise, and wondering if the panelists have any reason to doubt it, or other than just natural caution and suspicion. Thanks for taking my call.
Chuck, thanks for that. David Savage of the LA Times, you know, your thoughts on whether we will continue to see more moderate outcome, or really, or whether the fears of some people who expect an outpouring of more conservative decisions than they would have hoped for, whether those concerns are likely to play out?
Well, I think I'm going to say a little bit like John Roberts, that a little bit of both are true, that I think Roberts will, over time, move gradually to the right in a whole series of areas of the law. But I, as I say, I don't think he believes it's right for the court to move dramatically or to change the law in a big way. To take the area of religion, for example, there's a whole series of cases percolating around where the religious rights groups want to, for example, get students to be able to go to religious schools and get public funding for it. And they've got a case from Montana where Montana had a scholarship program for private school students. And you could go to a private school, but the state Supreme Court said, no, you can't go to a religious school. I think Roberts and Company is going to take a case like that and others like it and say, no, you can't discriminate against somebody because of his or her religious beliefs or because they're affiliated with a church. I think at some point in one of these wedding cake cases, they will say something like, if you're an employee who of a florist or a bakery and you have a religious objection to participating in a same-sex marriage, you have some sort of right, is either free speech or religion, not to do it. And I think there will be cases going that way over the next 10 years. They will not be dramatic, but there will be a move to the right. And as I say, Roberts would prefer to do it as sort of step-by-step, slowly, and not in a big dramatic change that sets off a lot of people.
David Savage of the LA Times. Let's take another caller. This is Dennis calling from Birmingham, Michigan. Dennis, welcome to On Point. Your thoughts about the upcoming Supreme Court term?
Hi. If they take up abortion, I do not see them doing anything radical. I think the court is somewhat politicized. I think they tend to follow what society says. And right now, and I could be wrong, but I think society is, for the most part, still gives the right for women to make their choices. Now, there are bans in many states right now, but I think they're not even, I think they're on hold right now. So I don't think, if they take up the abortion issue, I doubt very seriously if they do a total ban. I think if they did, it would be such a huge backlash. And I think Republicans would lose big time.
Dennis, thanks for that. And David Savage, let's talk a bit about abortion cases, because there is the potential the court will be hearing some. And even if they didn't do something as drastic as overturn Roe versus Wade, they could make decisions that would erode abortion rights, that would make it harder for women to find abortion clinics. Can you tell us a bit about the abortion cases that may be heard?
Your view is correct, I think, that they will take up cases and it will make it harder for women to obtain abortions, but it will not ban them. There's a case pending from Louisiana that looks like a very good candidate for them to grant and review, possibly on Friday. They talked about it during their private conference on Tuesday. Louisiana has a law that says every doctor who performs abortions must have admitting privileges at a hospital within 30 miles. That sounds like sort of an innocuous measure, but both Texas and Louisiana and a few other states had those laws. And those requirements had the effect of shutting down a lot of abortion clinics because, for a couple reasons, a lot of hospitals don't want to associate with an abortion doctor. And the doctors in these clinics send very few patients to hospitals. 3 years ago, the Supreme Court struck down a law from Texas, essentially the same law, on the grounds that it had the effect of knocking out something like two-thirds of the abortion clinics in Texas. The Supreme Court struck it down on a 5-3 vote. It was just after Justice Scalia died, with Justice Kennedy in the majority. Well, after Kennedy retired, the appeals court in New Orleans upheld the Louisiana law with the same provisions. and said, well, things are different in Louisiana. We think at least one of the clinics would remain open in the state, and essentially that's good enough. And the Supreme Court stopped that law from taking effect in February to allow the appeals to come forward. The appeal briefs are all in now, and my belief is the court will announce sometime in the next week or two that they're going to hear that case and decide it this term. And so the issue, as I say, is whether the state can enforce this admitting privileges rule, even if it has the effect of shutting down all or nearly all the clinics. And so it's a big abortion issue, but I can imagine Roberts going either way on that.
But David, as you said, the Supreme Court already struck down essentially an identical law in Texas 3 years ago. If it's already basically weighed in on this issue, why is it back before the court again?
Well, by the way, Roberts dissented in that case. And you would think that the appeals courts would have struck down the Louisiana law and said it's the same. But judges can view things differently, and they came up with some reasons why the Louisiana law was not that bad. You know, the law, Sandra O'Connor back in 1992 said states can regulate abortion but not put an undue burden on women seeking abortion. And as long as she was on the court, people sort of knew what that meant. But, you know, it's sort of a— it's not a very clear phrase, and some of the very conservative judges say, oh, this regulation, this law wouldn't put an undue burden on women. Abortion's still legal, and so they upheld it. Now, I do think John Roberts is a little hesitant for exactly the reason you said. It sort of looks out of line for the court in one case to declare such a law unconstitutional and then flip 3 years later, mostly because the personnel on the court has changed. But that will be the debate when they hear this Louisiana case, which, as I say, I think they will during this term.
Let's go to a caller from Boston. This is Jake. Jake, welcome to On Point. Your thoughts about the Supreme Court and the cases it's about to hear.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. My question is, my understanding of liberal versus conservative interpretations of the Constitution is that conservative justices tend to care more about precedent or stare decisis. Wouldn't this mean that conservative justices in the majority of the Supreme Court would be more likely to uphold something like Roe versus Wade?
That's an interesting question. David Savage of LA Times, would a conservative justice possibly be more likely to uphold Roe versus Wade because they tend to care more about precedent, if true?
No. No. I think Jake's view of conservative is a very reasonable view and was a very common view, but I don't think it's the current view. I think both the liberals and conservatives on the court are very willing to overturn a precedent that they think is just plain wrong and that the other side keeps coming back to them. The liberal justices overturned some very anti-gay opinions from the 1980s and whatnot, and said those opinions are wrong, they're abominable, we're going to overturn them. And the conservative justices, there was a handful of cases in the last term where they did that. Not really big issues, but very much fought out in the court. And I don't see any sign or any reason to believe that the conservative justices, as a matter of sort of conservative doctrine. In fact, Clarence Thomas would tell you, you know, my job is to enforce the Constitution as it is. It's not to stick with, you know, the decisions of this court if they were wrong. And so I don't think precedent will stand in the way in the end if the five of them think something is wrong.
David Savage, we have a piece of sound from one of the two of the newest Supreme Court justices. This is Justice Neil Gorsuch. And in early September, he shared his thoughts on civility in U.S. politics with USA Today in Washington. And here is what Neil Gorsuch said.
And the whole ideas behind a republic is a marketplace of ideas. But for it to work, we have to remember that we need to listen as well as talk, tolerate as well as demand tolerance. And remember that people with whom we disagree love this country every bit as much as we do.
And David Savage of the LA Times, I'm interested in how genuine you consider that sentiment by Neil Gorsuch, how much people who are concerned that they will see outcomes and decisions they don't hope for because of the new conservative majority, can actually be heartened that people like Neil Gorsuch are trying to take a very center-line view.
Well, I guess we will see over time. I do think Gorsuch is a very earnest, idealistic person and who talks a lot about civility. And he talks about it mostly with conservative audiences. And with the conservative audiences, he's basically saying the liberals out there that you say you disagree with, they love this country as much as you do. So I think it's a very good thing that he does that. I also think he is an interesting, surprising justice on a whole series of cases last term where he voted with the liberals on for sex offender cases or cases involving people, African-American, getting 50-year prison terms for a couple minor robberies, that Gorsuch is not a 100% predictable conservative on a lot of cases. He's very offended about laws that are vague or go too far or give prosecutors too much leeway. So I think he's an interesting person to watch over the next couple years. I think he will surprise people in a few ways. But I do think on the issues that really divide the court, things like abortion, he will be very much where I think Justice Scalia was, that thinking that a lot of those cases were incorrect interpretations of the Constitution from the start and that these are matters that states should debate on their own. They shouldn't be decided in federal court. So I think he will be conservative on the really biggest issues.
David Savage, before this hour ends, I want to talk about one more big issue that is going to be coming before the court, and that's immigration. I think two cases are expected to be heard in November. One about whether the Trump administration's effort to end DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program that when young people were brought to this country as undocumented parents, they can temporarily defer their deportation. That's one. Then there was this cross-border shooting where a U.S. Border Patrol officer shot a Mexican teenager who was hiding behind a pillar in a culvert right on the U.S.-Mexico border. That teenager's family is now saying that they should be able to basically bring a damages claim. Can you tell us a bit about those immigration cases and your thoughts about how those may play out?
Well, the DACA is obviously a big deal because it's 700,000 young people. President Obama issued this order saying we're going to defer deportation and allow work permits. These are the least culpable people. You know, they were brought to the country as children. That President Trump gave sort of mixed signals during the campaign. But then early in 2017, he said we're going to revoke the program. Some federal judges have blocked it, but entirely on procedural grounds. They said Trump's lawyers came up with a sort of phony reason. They said, oh, Obama's action was unconstitutional and illegal. They said it was not illegal, and the president has this authority. So the court's going to hear that case in November. I think it's one, you know, you would assume the five conservatives who voted to uphold the travel ban are probably going to lean in favor of saying the president has the authority to revoke this. Maybe go the other way, but I guess I will be surprised. The border shooting is an awful case, an awful situation. The court has refused to decide this case a couple times. This is another one. I guess I will be surprised if one of the five conservatives breaks ranks and says, yes, the officer can be sued and held liable for shooting across the border and killing this young man.
So those two cases, I think, are slated for November 12. So those are definitely going to be heard. And we should also note that, thousands of cases try to make their way to the Supreme Court. A very small number actually end up getting heard. And it could be through January, I believe, that the Supreme Court will continue to add cases to its docket for the upcoming term.
That's correct. Yes.
David Savage is a reporter at the LA Times covering the Supreme Court. He's been covering it since 1986. David, thank you very much for coming on the program today.
Thanks, Audrey.
And listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Thanks for staying with us this hour. And please join us again. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.